Former New York Times staff writer and author Lucinda Franks explores her improbable love affair and her marriage with longtime Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau in her new book, Timeless, Love, Morgenthau, and Me. She'll discuss the book when she visits Gear Village in Canaan, Connecticut on Friday, December 12th at 1:30. Lucinda Franks has written regularly for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and others. She was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for national reporting and has won many other awards. Again, her new book is Timeless, Love, Morgenthau, and Me. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Lucinda Franks to the roundtable.
Well, it's a pleasure, Joe, really.
So what brought you to tell this story, the subtitle Love, Morgenthau, and Me? What brought you to tell the story?
My husband is really one of the greatest men of his time. I think that's known, that's accepted. But he's known as a kind of stiff, stern, tough, intimidating prosecutor. And there's a whole other side of him. And I didn't want him to go down in history as someone that wasn't a full human being. So I figured he didn't just belong to me. He belonged to the people. And he deserved to be portrayed with all his humor and his foibles and his silliness and his kindnesses for little people, all the things that make him a human being. He wanted me to do this when I asked him. I was very surprised because he had refused every other publisher who had asked him to write his memoirs, because he didn't want to do that much work, and he didn't want to look back. And for me to do it was for him not to have to do so much work, because I knew a lot of it myself. We had been married for 36 years.
Well, let us ask how you met him, because when you met him, he was a widower. He had several children. And what was it like coming into that situation?
Well, Robert Morgenthau was, let me say, not the man of my dreams. I was a radical anti-war protester, something of a hippie. Those were the horrible Vietnam War days. And I was assigned to cover the Watergate story by United Press International. I went to interview Morgenthau, who had been in the Kennedy administration and just been fired by Nixon because he was looking into Nixon's Swiss bank accounts. And I asked so many questions during the interview that Bob thought I was either the smartest or the dumbest reporter he had ever met. When he read my story, he decided I was the smartest. So, you know, Bob could have put me in jail. I was chaining myself to White House fences, throwing blood on draft files. He could have put me in jail, but instead he asked me out on a date after that interview. And I never in a million years thought somebody 30 years older than me would be a candidate for my husband. But there was this wonderful forehead he had when I first interviewed him, and I couldn't really stop looking at it. It was this magnificent, large forehead, and I had this hippie poncho on, and he told me later that he kept dreaming about it. He kept thinking about that poncho. So Keith called it an objective correlative. But we were obviously attracted to each other, but we hung on to something that symbolized each other. So it was a very, very hard decision to make. But once you're caught by love, by surprise, you don't have any choice. I mean, you are caught. You are stuck. So I inherited 5 stepchildren, 2 dogs, 1 cat, and a district attorney of the city of New York.
as you said.
It was a challenge, believe me. The immediate reaction of his extended family, not so much his children who really liked me, but his extended cousins and nieces and nephews was utter shock. Back in the 70s, they didn't do things like that. Professionals of, 30 years apart did not marry each other normally. And they acted as though the Pope had asked Squeaky Foam to marry him. They were really wanting to stop this marriage. In fact, one cousin, on behalf of all the others, wrote him that he should see a psychiatrist before he went into this marriage, which, of course, he didn't. And all this opposition brought us closer together. We were kind of like a hoarier version of Romeo and Juliet. So we got married within a year.
The fact that the differences that separated the two of you really fueled the partnership, there are several examples to that. You helped him in many ways through the differences that you shared.
Yes.
When did you first see that evident?
This is a book that is a cornucopia. It has something for everyone. So it's a political history of the times of the last 30, 40 years. It's a love story. It's a story of a behind-the-scenes inside scoop of all the big cases, like Central Park Jogger and Sheila and Astor, all the big cases that Bob had. And it's the story of some of the big stories that I got that won the Pulitzer Prize and other awards. So we were mutually supportive to each other. We drew a line. I couldn't write about anything that he was investigating, and he wasn't supposed to mess with any of my stories. We kept to this bargain, but we also really leaned on each other to supplement what needed to be supplemented in our lives. I mean, I remember when this subway gunman, Bernie Goetz, I don't know if you remember that, when he shot several African-American boys, and the city was vociferously divided between people who wanted him to go to the electric chair and people who wanted him to go free. One of the boys was severely paralyzed, and his claim was that he was scared that they were going to rob him, mug him, kill him. The crime was at a great high during those days, and they said that they were just panhandling him. So Bob and I play-acted the roles of the victims and the perpetrator. Alleged perpetrator. I was Goetz. He was Daryl Cabby, one of the kids. He was Goetz. I was Daryl Cabby. It went back and forth. And we acted out what could have happened, what had happened, what didn't happen. And at the end of it, he really had the answer to whether he was going to indict Goetz or not. I mean, he didn't have to listen to public opinion. He was going to, in fact, go against public opinion because just understanding the threat that Goetz felt was not did not justify him taking out a gun and shooting these boys.
You took on this project of writing the book, and you are telling the stories. How much did you share with him as you were writing?
Just about every comma, every line, every word. I had a drawer full of journals that I've kept since I graduated from college. And we went through all the journals together. And believe me, things existed that we apparently did that we had no recollection. They only existed on the pages of my journal because neither of us remembered them. That's how, you know, fungible memory is. So as I was writing it, I would ask him about certain cases, certain incidents, anecdotes between us. And sometimes he would set me straight and, you know, really save me with a correct rendering of the fact, because his memory is prodigious. And sometimes I could go to him and point at some lines in my journal and say, no, it didn't happen the way you said it. It happened here. It's in black and white. And so we didn't have any arguments about what should stay in and what should go out of the book, because anything he really objected to went out. I mean, that was one thing that I trusted him on implicitly, because he is a very laissez-faire person. He kept saying, well, it's your memory. It's not mine. I don't want to interfere. And that was my clue to kind of try to dig out of him a deep feeling or some kind of objection that he had that he couldn't even put into words. That was how it went. It wasn't him censoring me. It was me delving into him to see if there was any censoring.
It's also fascinating when you read this book, because it's so much of a love story and so much going on, but also you have a high profile marriage, and that must play into it as well.
Well, yes, it did. I mean, in one sense, it was exhilarating. I had certainly, you know, in my own right, interviewed a lot of famous and distinguished people. Robert Redford called me 3 times. Wanting me to do stories about this and that. And I had, you know, a head of state that gave me an exclusive. So I had been in that society in a very minor way. But when I married Bob, I mean, here there were heads of state. You know, we traveled to see Ariel Sharon, and we advised him on how, you know, to handle Americans. We went to events. We met, we fell in love, actually, at a party in Arthur Schlesinger's home. And that's a kind of a funny story. But these people were, at first, it was exhilarating to meet these literary and political lights. But then it became, you know, business as usual. And what we really wanted was a life of our own. And everything else was extraneous. We really liked being together, just the two of us, more than anything else. And working and helping each other work.
And you do call it a love of two eccentrics.
Yes. Yes, we are. He comes home, and nobody knows this, or nobody knew it before my book, but this stern, poker-faced prosecutor would come through the door, throw off his coat, begin stomping around the house singing, "Give My Regards to Broadway." he was a humorous and a terrible prankster. He would have a hard day at the office, a terrible day, you know, to do with the Central Park jogger case. And he would come home, and there our 4-year-old boy would be standing with his arms out, and Bob would grab him and, you know, throw him into the air and say, we're flying. And it was just we had a very happy household that was in direct opposition to some of the terrible things that he was dealing with, from petty crime to terrorism, you know, to 9/11, all of which we both had involvement in trying to find out who the terrorists were that were behind this. There are some news scoops in this book, and one of them is the government, not the, I'm talking about the intelligence agencies, not the federal government or the local government, but the intelligence agencies' responsibility inadvertently for causing 9/11. And this is a complicated part of the book, but it is kind of a shocking one, or at least it was to Bob and me.
And with much of this, of course, is during the days when he was working as the DA, and how have things changed now without that constant pressure of the job?
Well, let me tell you something. I said, okay, now you're officially retired from the DA's office. Okay, you're going to work for a law firm. I understand that. But you've got to come home at a decent hour, you know, 4 o'clock, not 7:30. And he said, oh, yes, sure, I will. And that lasted for about 2 days. And then he began to come home about 6:30. And I said, what happened to this vow of yours? And he said, well, I'm coming home a half an hour earlier than I was before. I don't know what you're complaining about. So there are some people who work to live, and there are other people who live to work. And he's of the latter variety. He always wants to do the right thing, and he wants to help people, and he can't keep his hands off of issues in which people are suffering.
Well, the name of the book is Timeless, Love, Morgenthau, and Me. It is published by FSG. Lucinda Franks, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
Lucinda Franks will talk about her book Timeless, Love, Morgenthau, and Me when she visits Gear Village in Canaan, Connecticut, this Friday, December 12th at 1:30. You can find out more at Gear Cares, G-E-E-R, gearcares.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.